Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest, our former Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Officer and law enforcement analyst, Michael Fanone, and revered New York Times essayist and columnist, Thomas Edsel. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsors, Lomi and Hold On Bags, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, James, that Tennessee story keeps getting worse. They Republican right-wing legislators expelled two blacks for protesting the chamber floor over the refusal to enact gun control after three little children were killed 15 minutes away. There was another gun incident in Louisville where five people were slain by a killer with an AR assault rifle. In Tennessee, the upshot is that the black legislators became national symbols, and their localities are returning them to the legislature. Republicans, led by that House Speaker, who, thanks to Judd Legan, we learned he doesn't even live in the district, they became symbols of racist hypocrites. And it's a really good piece in Politico by a woman named Natalie Allison, who used to cover the Tennessee legislature. And she reported that this is the hypocrisy. Several years ago, they had no intention of expelling a Republican member accused of assaulting teenage girls. He even apologized to one. So I think this is a story that it shows you exactly what they're all about. And I hope it's going to redound to the advantage of those black legislators and blacks elsewhere. What do you think?
Well, I tell you something that I think is the two Justins, Jones and Pearson, one's from Nashville and one, they're very smart, very articulate people. I mean, these are people of considerable depth. That speaker looks like he was the kind of guy who got held back a couple of years in homeschooling. He's not a very smart guy. And when you listen to the other ones, they're not very smart. And you know, at some point, I think people are going to see through this, that these are really lifelong slow learners. And what they do makes no sense. Of course, that they're stupid and they're arrogant. And that's why you end up with this. But I thought the two Justins and the woman from I guess she was from Knoxville, he said, "Why do you think I didn't get kicked out? Look at me, I'm white." Was good too. So you're right. But the Democrats don't do very well in Tennessee. It's a tragedy. I don't know how we come back. But boy, I tell you what, on IQ points, we're killing them. We're just killing them.
Well, I like that, but I'd like it even better if we do better in election points. And I guess you think it's not going to make much difference there.
I hope I'm wrong, but where it can make a difference in what I'm going to be looking at, and I'll talk about this if you don't need to, is in hopefully, you know, I've been very big, and this program has been very big on tepid black turnout. Let's just call it what it is. All right, It was not very good, and you know, we got a big test coming up this fall in Mississippi, and Justin Jones is actually a graduate student at the Vanderbilt Divinity School, which is Wake Forest has one of the things, like five others around the country, but right. You know, it's obviously a very good one. And he's very smart, and he's very schooled in religious tradition. And boy, would I love to see him. I think we might see him in the Mississippi Delta, or see him in Hinds County, and some other places talking this up. Because at some point, when you look at what they did to these guys, and you look at the way that race was involved in it. I mean, the white people can pee in each other's chairs. They don't do anything.
And they did.
Yeah, they did. They did. Right. And they were actually protesting the shooting of children, which seems to me to be a pretty noble thing to protest. I mean, I'm not for shooting children. And I'm in fact, I'm very much against it, as are they. So I hope we can, I hate to be political here, but people need to see what's happening in this country and need to do what the people in Wisconsin did and respond to it through the ballot box.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, there was that other terrible shooting in Louisville. Five people were killed. And I saw something that was saying, well, that gun was purchased legally. Yes, that's the problem. It was an assault weapon. Assault weapons should be banned. And it, the people who were, there were, you know, some really great citizens were killed. And one person who said, you know, it was a, one was a close friend of the governor, but Senator Rick Scott from Florida said, you know, this guy was a good friend of mine. Okay, Senator Scott, he's a good friend of yours. Here's how you can pay homage to him. Ban assault weapons. I don't. I'm not gonna hold my breath, James.
Of course, I know the governor quite well. He's really talented. Let me tell you, when you talk about the young talent we have in the party, and we talk about Wes Moore and people like that as we should, man, Andy Beshear is right at the top. Of course, he lost a couple of friends in there, and that guy Thomas Massey, you know, we're a fucking jerk, sends out something. But what's really, nothing is funny about this, but anytime that Ted Cruz makes a fucking fool out of himself, it's got to make you feel good. I think like the day before, he used banks as an example of the way schools should be. Should make every school like a bank. Maybe have a vault and a guard. But
James, if you apply that test, we're getting a lot of pleasure because Ted's making a fool out of himself more than once a week.
Yeah, you take the little pleasures in life, and trust me, that's about all we're getting right now is little pleasures in life. But him making a fool of himself never ever goes sour.
James, I'll tell you who's getting a lot of pleasures in life, and that is Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. ProPublica broke the news that he's accepted millions of dollars worth of free trips in private planes and on yachts, lodging, and gifts from a white right-wing Texas billionaire, Harlan Crow, whose hobby is that he loves to collect Hitler and Nazi memorabilia. Now, the Supreme Court has incredibly lax ethics rules. We know that. But this is really sleazy, even by those rules. Thomas and his political right-wing wife, Ginny Thomas, and their fixer, Mark Bialetta, and the Supreme Court nomination fixer, Leonard Leo, hanging out with a rich guy who's obviously affected by court decisions. And Slate's Dahlia Lithwick, who, despite Walter Dellinger's urgings, I have never met, but she's really good. And she says, I'm sorry, this is not just an ethical violation. Thomas clearly broke the law, except we know nothing will come of it, except a further erosion of any confidence in the Supreme Court.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I read a piece, and it was in a sort of mainstream New York Atlantic or something like that. And it's, well, a lot of people collector stuff. He had Stalin memorabilia, and he had this, and maybe the guy. But when you have Adolf Hitler's initials embroidered in napkins, I don't know. You know, I mean, I understand that. You know, people collect certain things, and but then that and this guy, you know, a guy like this doesn't like think that. Ginny and Clarence. The only thing is, I don't know how much money they spent on the fuel on the boat or the fuel on a Bombardier 500 airplane. But I'll tell you, feeding them food for 30 days could break a billionaire with those two. Jesus, so much can they eat?
Anyway,
and I don't know what the added weight on the plane and the cost, but he definitely had to burn some more fuel.
Yeah. Well, James, I'll tell you, just going back just for one second to guns, I'll tell you what depresses me. There's a column this week written by Karen Tumulty, one of my very favorite columnists. And she went back and she revisited Uvalde. And you know what? The Republicans paid no price for that. The governor, the lieutenant governor, the attorney general all did better in Uvalde last November than they did 4 years before. That's just depressing.
It's depressing, but, you know, it's the reality of it. If your DNA and your sense of resentment, if shooting children doesn't move it, man, I don't know. Maybe there's not a 30-second ad out there that can do it. And I mean, Abbott's behavior in this was just awful, and being at a fundraiser and everything. And, you know, I brought everybody in, and Matthew McConaughey, hats off to him. And, you know, it's depressing because what changes, well, something changes. If anything, it gets worse.
Yeah.
And I think, unfortunately, we ain't going to be around to see it, but hopefully the next generation can do something. Because right now, I say that, but the Wisconsin thing, we got to report good news where it is. The Wisconsin thing was really good news.
Yep. It really was.
And I'm still a believer that there's a lot of freaking talent in the Democratic Party. We just got to figure a way to get it out on the field.
Yeah, we do. Okay. We aren't going to ignore the good news, I promise you. Hey, James, our guest is the great essayist and columnist for the New York Times. Some people think the very best, Tom Etzel, always insightful, talks to smart academics, and is able to understand the rhythms of American politics as well, if not better than anyone. Hey, Tom, you've written a brilliant piece in Wednesday's New York Times, "Republicans Move to the Hard Right, Electing Extremist Proud Boy Types from Oregon to Florida." One analyst notes that for the right, violence no longer is a fringe position. I mean, this is frightening. And are there Republicans standing up to this real threat?
I don't see any significant Republican opposition to this. It really seems to flow like water off a duck. And there's some minor, the Never Trumpers, the Mitt Romneys, but on the whole, these things are going on, and they're going on with the acquiescence of the Republican leadership.
And going on at the local level much more than is commonly understood.
Yeah, I think this the role of people like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers becoming active members of local Republican executive committees, state and local, is becoming increasingly commonplace. Steve Bannon has really been pushing this as a theory for a takeover of the party. And it's very similar to what the Christian Coalition did way back in the late 80s, where they took over a whole bunch of Southern Republican parties. The same thing is slowly taking place at the local level from Miami to Oregon. And it's there needs to be much. I think what's happened in this is the fact that we've lost so many newspapers, no one covers this stuff anymore.
Right.
And it goes on under the radar without any notice, and suddenly a Republican party like in Clackamas County, Oregon, suddenly the chairman and the vice chairman of the party are members of these extremist groups. And at any rate, it's an ongoing thing, and you don't hear any Oregon Republicans complaining about this. It's just a continuing phenomenon with a slow motion kind of revolution taking place.
Tom, you put that together with voting restrictions, radical gerrymandering, wiping away the rights of the opposition. It is, as one political scientist told you, turning in to a minority authoritarianism, more like today's Hungary, or even some earlier fascist models. Is that an overstatement?
Well, I think the idea of a minority authoritarian party is gaining increasing credibility. You see this in terms of what the Republican Party has been pushing at the state level, where more and more state parties are enacting legislation giving partisan groups, i.e. the state legislature itself, power over election outcomes to decide who were the winners. This is what Trump wanted in 2020, but he couldn't do it because it was illegal, basically. What he wants now is to transfer this crucial power to decide who the winners are and who gets the Electoral College votes to partisan groups who could then overturn the results that would appear to be more accurate with another winner. and you at the same time have a court case pending before the Supreme Court, the independent legislative, I can't remember the exact title of the theory, but the theory is that state governments do have this power, although it's a disputed theory. But given this court, there's no reason to think that they might not, well, might not take that view.
Well, what should Democrats be doing? One of your experts said the problem with Democrats is they too often they just call these extremist names, which they are, but they fail to address or understand that there are some real grievances and resentments from rank and file. Are there things Democrats could do better, Tom?
Well, it's really a two-pronged question. They could do a lot better appealing to white working class voters who are crucial to this Republican takeover. And that's a whole big strategic and policy-making decision. They could also do much more to highlight what's going on now. I think the Senate, which is what the Democrats have control, could be used much like Republicans in the House are doing. But in the Democratic Senate, they could use it to hold hearings on these phenomena, like the Proud Boys taking place, the denial of abortions to women who are in extreme situations where their fetus is virtually dead. There are all kinds of things that could be done to start pushing these the role of what really is minority authoritarianism, which means basically policies that are not supported by the majority but promoted successfully by the minority. The Democrats could highlight this much more aggressively.
Tom, I'm going to turn it over to James, but for 15 years from now, look at your crystal ball. Will this kind of really, really radical extremism likely have run its course, or might it even be more dangerous?
Well, I think looking at it, it seems to be gaining momentum. If anything, things are getting worse and worse. And what I describe in the column, the whole process has been accelerating. And the institutional breaks that you normally see in a party, the pressures to move back to the center, don't seem to be working within the Republican Party. So I don't see this at the moment as a phenomenon that's likely to sort of run its course and run out of gas. At the moment, it seems to be gaining momentum and gaining energy at the same time on the right. The big question is, can the Democrats quash it? And the ultimate way to quash it is to win elections.
To win elections,
show
yeah.
That it's a totally losing proposition.
James.
So, Tom, one of the most influential magazine pieces I think probably ever written, I went back and reread it, was Hannah Arendt covering the Eichmann trial, and she called it the banality of evil. He looked just like us. But it's probably a guy that, picked his kids up from school or whatever. And these people are everywhere around us, and they're not like Steve Bannon. They don't wear horns. But you don't know how inbred they are in American culture, American society. And the number of people that have become comfortable with the idea of violence, I think is growing every day. Is that your impression?
I think you're right, but I think I wouldn't want to demonize all these people. There's something going on where basically fundamentally decent people are adopting really bad policies or bad outlooks, and they're tolerating things. People that you wouldn't mind, sharing a breakfast with or a beer with, they're going off the rails.
All right. So you get into my central point. So one of the people I called was a woman named Kirschfield, I think, something like that. And she said, look, this is a Republican phenomena, but of course we have to have this. The Democrats at fault too, because maybe we didn't, maybe free trade, screwed their lives, or maybe they don't like, integration, or they don't like gay people or something. That is not a freaking excuse for violence. That's an excuse to vote against someone. And when smart people lapse in and say, yeah, they're violent, and, you know, they riot at the Capitol. But you got to admit, Jim, you know, a lot of these people feel divorced from the cultural superiority of the Democratic Party. Well, okay, I'll buy that. That doesn't give you the frickin' right to shoot somebody or beat a police officer over the head with a tattoo. And I just think we're too... just see it every time I read something. So I knew we were going to come here. Well, oh yeah, but it's part of our fault. It may be our fault that they vote against us, but that doesn't. We can't let them off and say, well, you've got screwed. Your income hadn't gone up. You're living lives of despair and deaths of despair. So therefore, go out and fucking shoot a black person. Doesn't make sense. I mean, that's my general view.
I don't disagree with you. The issue is, how do you get that message to the people who do just what you describe, who beat the cop over the head with a fire hydrant, right, or whatever it is? I don't know how you get those people back to their fundamental decency, or maybe they've lost their decency.
It is not my fault that they are violent. Okay, it might be the collective Democratic fault. It made that certainly policies that it embraced, they felt like hasn't gone for them. I don't know, but they all for the freaking minimum wage and Medicare and Medicaid and, you know, everything else. But all I'm saying is there has to be a way that we can resolve political conflict without violence, and really very little, if anything, can justify violence. That's my general view.
No argument, okay. but it doesn't resolve how you get these people off their violent kick.
I
know it's not, you're saying it's not your responsibility to do that. It's not, but it's not theirs. They're not taking that responsibility.
Well, maybe they're just shitty-ass racist people. Have we just thought about that? That might be one explanation?
I think that is an explanation for maybe 35, 40%, maybe even 50% of what's going on. But there's some... I spent a lot of time talking to voters going around and to places where you see a lot of this now, these super Trump precincts. And these are not, on the whole, evil racist people. There's something gone wrong, and it's come out in an expression that is way off the it's just way out of line. But if you want to say they're all racist, fine.
I don't,
what do we do?
I'm turning it back out because maybe I'm just not being clear. I don't say they don't have a grievance. I don't say that black people don't have a grievance or Native Americans don't have a grievance. We would not say your grievance should manifest itself with violence.
We've got
so freaking much liberal guilt here. Well, maybe we didn't do this. And I know a lot of these people. I hate to say this, but I think some of them might even be close to me. And they look like you and I. They go to church on Sunday. If you're sick, they'll bring a casserole to you. They'll drive you to the doctor. All right? That's what the banality of it. But when you accept violence, you've crossed something here, and you don't deserve sympathy, and you're just a bad person. I'm sorry.
You may have touched on something there, that this idea of liberal guilt, I think, has turned the Democratic Party and a large wing of the Democratic Party into kind of a lost toughness and the willingness to take on what's going on here. I think people push, and when they don't get pushed back, they push harder, and that's what's taking place on the right. And the left doesn't push back. I agree. And you can't tolerate violence, but it means being a lot tougher and more aggressive than what you've seen from the Democratic side. I think if the Democratic Party itself was better equipped to stand up and fight, these people would back off, and they would make them have to have second thoughts.
Before I turn it over to Al, because I've been wondering about this.
A couple of loose ends. How central is race to this, to these right-wing extremists?
It's no question that race is what started the whole thing. And race now intermixes with every other issue. Race and taxes, race and regulation, race and immigration, all of them compound each other. If anything, as I say, that whole process began really in the 64 Civil Rights Act, which turned the Democratic Party into a liberal party and the Republican Party into a conservative party. But that since then, over the next 60 years, these race has intersected with virtually every other major controversial issue.
Yeah.
And you can't escape race. Race is a big issue. And if anything, it seems to get bigger.
Yeah, it does. And Rui Scheera and others, and I think you've written about this too, say the Democrats have focused too much on cultural issues and lost the white working class votes. On the other hand, the abortion issue particularly with the pill now, is a huge winning issue. I guess the answer is that they have to more artfully walk and chew gum at the same time and not choose one over the other.
Well, the white working class, I think the Democratic Party is, in theory, the party of the working class, white, black, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. Losing the white working class has really undermined the Democratic Party's credibility as the advocate of the working man and woman. And that's a ongoing problem, and it makes it very hard for the party to claim its central, what had been its central mantle.
Yeah.
That's a whole new different discussion.
Well, you said earlier the only way to stop this is at the ballot box. You know, Democrats in the whole say 2022 was a really good election. Historically, we did much better than in the past. I'm not sure of that. It seems to me if you look at what they were running against, a party that denied a presidential election, a party that countenanced a violent mob attacking the Capitol, a party that countenanced some of these violent extremists that you're talking about, you know, that should have been the opportunity to really deal them a big blow, and it didn't happen. And there's little indication it's going to happen in 2024, Tom.
Well, the reality is that we now have such a polarized electorate that each party goes into every election with at least 45% of the vote locked in. So you're talking about a tiny margin, so that winning big or losing big just doesn't happen. It hasn't happened for almost two decades where you've had a landslide election, maybe more than that.
Yeah.
And so you don't, elections are no longer referenda. They are assertions of your partisanship as opposed to a judgment by voters that elected officials are good or bad. And that makes it very hard if the Republicans are, and I agree, as bad as you describe, in theory, the electorate would rise up against them. But here Donald Trump looks like he's going to be the nominee in 2024. I think he's going to get at least 45% of the vote. I think he's going to probably lose, but he's probably going to get 45% of the vote. There's this, or maybe even 48%. So it's we have a new animal in politics these days.
Well, you've been the tiebreaker because James and I have disagreed James has now said he thinks it's likely Trump will be the nominee. I'm not quite sure what will happen, but I think it won't be. But you are much closer to James's position, I gather.
My theory is that bad things are likely.
Well, of course, that could be someone other than Trump, too.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, okay.
Okay,
James.
So, Tom, I think we can start with a general statement on everything. Violence is not an answer to grievance. All right. And I'm very, somebody says, well, guy hijacked, carjacked. And so we got to understand. He grew up in poverty. Okay, understand that. But that's not a, violence is not, should not manifest itself in grievance. And we cannot excuse, you know, advocating violence for somebody's perceived grievance, or maybe it's a real grievance. But everybody's got a grievance somewhere. And I just think that some people go out of their way and say, well, you got to understand. I know they have a lot of things happening. Their lives didn't turn out right. But that's just a general statement that I would make, and I would make it to the people who excuse crime based on a legitimate grievance that someone has, and we provide them with shitty schools, and they didn't have a support system, and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't excuse violence, and neither does this. But before I let you go, because one thing that's annoying at me, and I hear all this two America stuff. We got white American, black American, coastal American, interior America, and we get to, what really strikes me that we have two Americas is age. I mean, more or less people married, I mean, people born after 1980 and people born before 1980. And they're different demographically, they're different attitudinally. They different on a lot of different levels. And I think that also drives some of this. I mean, I can't tell you a number of times people call me from focus groups and say, you know, they grandkids come home from college and they got this stuff. And there's real generational tension in this country, I think.
No argument.
Well, I think everybody out there ought to read Tom Etzel's piece in the New York Times Wednesday, the essay. It's frightening. You're not going to feel better after you read it, but you're going to know a lot more what you're frightened about. So
it's
anyway,
to feel good about.
Tom Etzel, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
Thank you, guys. It's good to be with you.
Hey, James, our guest is Michael Fanone, a brave Metropolitan police officer who self-deployed to help the Capitol Police, one of those brave Capitol Police, on January the 6th. He actually saw exactly what happened and has a book out called Holding the Line. The insurrectionists that day brutally beat him with a pipe, threatened him with his own gun. He suffered a heart attack and a brain injury, and he's now telling the whole story. Michael, I cannot tell you how much we admire your courage. Some 1,000 people have been charged with January the 6th, almost half pled or convicted. I think there are 250 or so incarcerated. Is justice being served?
I guess in some respects, yes. You know, the people that went to the Capitol that committed crimes on January 6th, they're being held to account. The 1,000-plus individuals that you just mentioned who committed a variety of different crimes, some very serious, some less serious, but all part of an attempt to subvert our democracy, to prevent Congress from certifying a free and fair election and doing so by force. That being said, The individuals, the former president and those in his inner circle who were responsible for inspiring those Americans to go to the Capitol and commit acts of violence have not yet been held to account.
You were a Trump voter in 2016. Do you think Trump should be prosecuted for what happened that day of infamy?
Absolutely. I mean, if you had asked me on January 7th, 2021, if I felt like Donald Trump was morally and ethically responsible for what happened to me and the 140 other MPD officers and U.S. Capitol Police officers that were injured, I would have told you, hell yes. But now, having sat through what I feel like was a very thorough investigation conducted by the House Select Committee, I believe that Donald Trump bears criminal culpability, along with, you know, many of his supporters, enablers, bear criminal culpability for what happened that day.
Yeah, this has been really irrationally politicized. When you and your colleagues were honored by the House of Representatives, the only Republicans who showed up in the chamber were Liz Cheney and her dad. Now, last week or 2 weeks ago, Marjorie Taylor Greene visited the D.C. jail to complain that the insurrectionists weren't being treated nicely enough. How did that affect you?
I guess it all started when Representative, I forget his name, from Georgia, characterized the day as a regular tourist day at the Capitol.
Right.
I mean, that's when the insanity, for me at least, with regards to January 6th started. So now, Marjorie Taylor Greene is batshit crazy. That's type of, behavior that I've come to expect, and I think many Americans have come to expect from her. But it is, it's outrageous. It's disappointing to see a member of a political party that claims to support law enforcement show up to D.C. jail. And I think it's important for your viewers to understand the only people that are still incarcerated in D.C. jail, and there's about two dozen of them, are there because they committed acts of violence against police officers. They're not there for criminal trespass. They're not there for, destruction of property. They're there because they beat the shit out of cops. And so, let's understand what Marjorie Taylor Greene and her cohorts that went there to investigate the atrocities being committed against these upstanding patriotic citizens. The reality is these are people that did violence against police officers.
The Law and Order Party. You also said that Kevin McCarthy, and I'm quoting you now, in public, he's praised the police, but behind closed doors, he doesn't really give a shit. Elaborate.
Yeah, no, I mean, this isn't the only example of political pandering that exists, and on both sides of the political aisle, but, I've dealt with it mostly from the Republicans in that, they claim to be supportive of law enforcement and yet they didn't do anything to help law enforcement. And in fact, many of the, policies and laws, I guess, that they have been supportive are actually problematic for police in this country and even detrimental to us accomplishing the job that that we need to do.
James.
So Michael, let's take January 6th forward. Tell us a little bit about your life and what kind of threats that you have been under as a result of you literally having a heart attack and getting beaten to try to save the United States. Have you gotten a lot of threats from different people online, or your family, your children? I saw where your daughter helped you get here today. What's been that reaction from those people?
I mean, I received quite a few threats. They really started, I would say the most significant threats began just after I testified before Congress. And I took my testimony seriously. I felt as though it was an extension of my service, not only on January 6th, but in the two decades I spent as a D.C. police officer. I'm a cop. My job is to, apprehend the bad guy and then appear in court and testify about my experiences truthfully, which is exactly what I did before the Select Committee. Afterwards, I was, characterized by members of the, right-wing entertainment media, people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham. And I understand that for what it is, and I don't really take it personally. I spent two decades as a cop tangling with some of the most expensive defense attorneys money can buy, so I understand theatrics and courtroom theatrics. But there were people, that listened to Tucker and Laura talk about me and talk about the events of that day. And and then mirror that language in their threats against my life and that of my family members. And so much so that it inspired some to visit, you know, my father's house, my ex-wife's house. And those threats continue to this day. And it's unfortunate, you know, listen, I understand that typically when you're investigating a threat against someone's life, there has to be an overt action and the threat has to be specific. But that doesn't mean that it's not traumatic to have someone out there who takes the time to pick up the phone, find my phone number, and call me and tell me that they wish, you know, death upon me and my children is, it's difficult to deal with. And it happens frequently.
So let's talk, you had a heart attack on January 6th, is that correct?
Yes.
And did your cardiologist said that it was stress induced by those events? Is that the diagnosis that you got?
Yeah, so when I was driven to the emergency room and I was there, they told me that I had had a spike in my troponin levels, which I guess is what they, you know, use to determine whether or not you've had some type of a cardiac event. And it was later from, you know, speaking with my cardiologist that they, you know, he felt as though based on my age and the fact that I'm, you know, in good physical condition.
I know you're in good physical condition. Go ahead.
I was struck with a taser device on my neck, somewhere between, you know, five or seven times. And as a result of that, you know, electroshock, as well as the assault against me, they believe that that's what accounted for the traumatic brain injury as well as the heart attack.
So are you feeling okay today? Physically, are you recovered?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm fortunate. Physically, I made a full recovery, at least in my mind. You know, that, and again, like, I had two decades in law enforcement to fall back on when it came to dealing with the physical violence that I experienced on January 6th. I mean, it was not my first rodeo. I never experienced anything like that, but it's not the first time I got punched in the face. What was the most difficult was dealing with the indifference from lawmakers, the indifference from my fellow Americans, from the greater law enforcement community at large. And, you know, and then this attempt to whitewash what happened that day. You know, you've got a portion of the Republican Party that just wants to sell you some bullshit, that it was Antifa or that, it was some false flag operation that was put forth by Nancy Pelosi, the FBI, and fucking space aliens. And then you've got a lot of other Republicans that just want to compare it to the summertime riots, which, you know, listen, a lot of cops got injured during that as well. But at no point in time did I ever feel as though democracy and this government were at risk by people breaking into CVSs and throwing, you know, piss-filled bottles at police officers. That's just been difficult to deal with. And still continues to this day.
Well, I thank you so much. Like I said, you and I have had a couple of times to interact with each other. And I think I thank you so much for speaking, Howard. I think you're a person of tremendous courage. And I know your children look at you that way. And I hope you continue your voice because I think it's an important voice. And I think political violence is the, you know, we had Tom Etzel on today, and political violence is a very troubling thing, and you were the victim of political violence, and you have an important voice against it. So thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, you do. And Michael, several times we mentioned in this show, there's still tragically, are people who think, well, there were mainly peaceful protesters, maybe a few bad apples. I have on multiple occasions recommended everybody who has any questions should watch an HBO special, 4 hours at the Capitol. It was a war against an angry, violent mob that wanted to overturn democracy, and it's captured in that HBO special. And it was only through the courage of people like you, Michael, that it was prevented. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, now for the outrage of the week. In North Carolina, Democratic State Rep. Tricia Cotham suddenly switched parties. Now, that's not unusual in some states. James, in your home state of Louisiana, it happens with some frequency. But in a heavily polarized Tar Heel state, it really is rare. Maybe it was to protect her seat, as Republicans will control redistricting. But she gave the GOP a supermajority in that state house, which can override any veto of Governor Cooper. Now, that takes us to abortion. Less than 10 weeks earlier, Rep. Cotham co-sponsored a bill that would codify abortion rights. Years earlier, she gave an impassioned personal speech on the floor against abortion restrictions, knowing how she once ended a life-threatening pregnancy. And I quote her, quote, "My womb and my uterus is not up for your grab, legislators. You don't hold shares in my body," end quote. Pretty soon, Republicans are expected to bring up a very stringent anti-abortion measure, which probably could only override a Cooper veto with Tricia Cotham's support. If so, if she supports that, if she supports the anti-abortion thing 10 weeks after her earlier statement, some investigative reporter needs to find out what she got for this flip-flop on what she said was a moral issue.
Well, I suspect what she got, you know, I don't know it to a certainty, but if I were looking, I would think that some money changed hands. That'd be the first place I'd look. Mm-hmm. This thing, there's something smells in Denmark here, and it's not cheese.
And in Raleigh, you're right.
No. I promise you. That's as good. I mean, there's so many things to be outraged about. I guess the thing that I'm most outraged about, and even more than Tennessee, is this thing in Texas, where a jury deliberated 17 hours. A jury, 12 people deliberated 17 hours, came to a verdict, and now Greg Abbott, to simplify the case, a guy ran into some protesters or whatever, and they put on a vigorous defense. Jury weighed the defense and didn't buy it. And this is sickening. And I hate to say this, but people seem to be getting increasingly comfortable with a race war in this country. And I mean that. And I know that's a controversial thing to say, and I don't think everybody is that way. I don't think a majority of the people are that way, but it sure does look like some people in high places are pretty comfortable with some version of a race war, which, by the way, I'm decidedly uncomfortable with on many different fronts. It's really, you know, this show having Tom on is important, and somebody's got to raise the alarm here.
Well, you're right, James, and this was a white man who had earlier texted out, he was really upset with the Black Lives Matter protesters and said, "I might have to kill somebody." And then when he did, he claimed it was in self-defense. The jury said no, it wasn't. And Governor Abbott decided to pardon him after getting pressure from Tucker Carlson. I'd love for the governor to answer a question, which he couldn't do, honestly, I'm sure. If the shoe was on the other foot, if there were, say, a Trump rally and a black man drove into the crowd and went and thought he was and then killed one of the Trump supporters, do you think, and under any circumstances, that Governor Abbott would have considered a pardon, James?
No. I mean, of course,
it's a ridiculous
we know that.
Question,
but the important thing here is the system worked. He had a defense. It presented a vigorous defense. The jury took its obligation really seriously to the point they deliberated for 17 freaking hours. And then he's good, you know, he can't pardon directly in Texas because of Pa Ferguson and Ma Ferguson were people selling pardons back then, but he controls the pardon parole board. Suspect they will. But this is all, people are getting, some people are getting increasingly comfortable with a race war. And this is what a race war, it's not a race war, this is what a race battle looks like.
Yeah.
And, you know, what scares me, you know, if I was a black person, I'd be a little bit like, well, fuck this. They're not going to protect me. So maybe I need to go on the offensive. That's how this shit starts. And, right. You know, I don't agree with the logic, but kind of understand how you'd come from that. I mean, it really, really is bad. And they're not going to stop here. They're just going to keep going. They're just going to keep going. And this was an unbelievable thing. And they talk about the rule of law. And they talk about cracking down on violence. What are you doing? Now you can tell I'm particularly upset about this, but we got a problem.
Okay, James, and now for the questions from our terrific listeners. They are really smart. Lawrence in Santa Barbara says, he's taking you on, James. He says, Biden is the best president of his lifetime. You know, Eisenhower forward. Is age the only prejudice why he shouldn't be reelected? And what would a second Biden term look like in your estimation?
It's all age, 100%. He deserves, by any criteria, of deserves reelection or based on his record, of course he does. But understand, it's just another poll. Two polls come out. 65% of people don't want him to do this. And you're right. You know, we could rattle off more people employed any other time in the last 50 years, more people in health insurance maybe any other time in American history. Inflation is, you know, this something drives me crazy with the press. You know, they always got to say, well, it looks good, but you got to go a little bit beneath. No, it's actually pretty good. And since you have all of this, but for age, I mean, it's like saying Babe Ruth shouldn't have retired or Henry Aaron. I don't know. You name it. In age is a detriment to everything, and I hate to say this, but we're older people. But yes, the answer to your question, my friend out in Santa Barbara, well, by the way, I'm going to be in a couple of weeks in Las Olivas in Santa Barbara County. It's just a stunning part of the world. You're right. Age is my it's 100% my reluctance, my belief that Biden should really think hard about whether he wants re-election or not.
Well, I agree with James. So, Lawrence, you've heard us out on this. Write back and tell us whether we've persuaded you at all, because we agree. He has been. If he got out, he would be the best one-term president in the history of the country.
Better, most two-term presidents.
That is not a small achievement. And no. I'll tell you what else would happen. Those Jim Jordan and Comer and all those witch hunt hearings on the Hill on Hunter Biden and on his daughter, they'd come to a screeching halt and save him a lot of personal anguish.
There's nothing going to come of this. And the one thing, the one answer on Hunter Biden is, do you know who the U.S. attorney is in Delaware?
Who was he appointed by, James?
By Donald Trump. And was kept in there. And has been told he has he can conduct his investigation. Okay, you know, but we get in the weeds of Hunter's laptop and did he use drugs and but whatever else. Well, okay, who's covering anything up? You only got the entire power of the federal government behind you. I mean, there's just one simple thing we should say, and that's it. Yeah. Excuse me. If you can tell me that, we can resolve this pretty quickly.
Yeah, I agree. Tommy in Marietta, Georgia. It's a good question. He asked me. He said, Al, the victim's family's consent, is there anything preventing the news media from broadcasting unredacted images of people shot by an AR-15? I'm thinking people can see what AR-15s do to a person's body, especially a child's body. That may bring some more pressure on politicians. Tommy, I agree with you. I don't think I would have a few years ago. The Washington Post did a simulation of it, I believe, several weeks ago that was just gruesome. But I agree. I mean, something has to be done. People kind of, they just move on. They shut their eyes to this. But show what it does. Show what it did to that little seven-year-old kid in Nashville. I think you have a very good point, Tommy.
You know, when I had Marjory Stoneman Douglas, I try not to think about it. I was teaching at LSU, and I called ROTC and said, can you get somebody to bring up AR-15 in my class? And I plug up the thing, empty the magazine. Fucking university had a conniption, and you couldn't do it to put it back. Because I wanted people to hold one of these things in your hand, just so you know what you're talking about. Just pass it around, all right, and see what it is. And I will repeat this to the point of, we actually banned them from 1994 to 2004, and there were hardly any mass shootings, all right? But they came back. It was one of the most horrific. Banning these assault weapons, one of the best policy decisions we've ever made as a country, and extinguishing the ban is not renewing it is one of the worst. Yeah. And we're paying for it every fucking day, every day. But I had one of my kids was getting ready to be commissioned, and his dad was a retired Army colonel. He's actually on the Fort Leesville police. He came and did a video demonstration of what it was and how to clean an AR-15. But until you pick one of these fucking things up, go to a gun store and just say you want to look at one and put it in your hands. Ask yourself, what's that good for?
Yeah.
For shooting eight-year-olds, let me tell you.
Yes, and you're not bagging Bambi with an AR-15.
No.
You're just killing kids. No. Anyway, Andrew in Duval County, Florida, says, looking at 2024 and beyond, should national Democrats ignore Florida completely?
Ooh.
Would it be wiser for Democrats to leave Florida in the dust and focusing instead on states like Georgia, Arizona, and possibly North Carolina while cementing their 2020 wins in the Midwest blue wall?
Man, what a wheelhouse question, because I was on the phone a lot yesterday, and I'm not going to kid you that it was a terrible outcome in 2022 in Florida. I don't want to go begin to debate the reasons. It wasn't in 2018. I think Bill Nelson lost by like under 10,000 votes. The reason that I think we should really work hard to get a candidate in Florida is. You know, who knows? Things change. But Rick Scott is up for re-election. And what do we know about Rick Scott? He's the poster boy for raising taxes on working people like you would not believe, all right? He is the poster boy for sunsetting Social Security and Medicare. And if I were if a donor, and this happens to me quite often, well, James, why should I send money to Florida? Because we only have, according to 538 of, I don't know, whoever, we only got an 18% chance of winning. But yeah, that's where you run a strong campaign and you actually make them pay for Rick Scott. Rick Scott is an albatross around them if we leverage it and exploit it. So that's, if we do it good enough, who knows? We may win. We got to think this out. We got to get a good candidate. And we got to go right after Rick Scott and wrap him around the whole goddamn Republican Party.
Well, James, I hope you're right. There was an awful good candidate last time in Val Demings, and maybe she could run again. But I'll tell you this, if I were a Democratic presidential candidate in 2024 and I wanted to put together my target of 320 electoral votes, Florida wouldn't be there. Florida wouldn't be there. Ohio wouldn't be there. Iowa wouldn't be there. They would be the bonus if there's going to be an unexpected decisive victory. But, they're better targets.
You win a party, you win everything. But all I'm saying is Rick Scott is so much more odious to American public opinion than AOC or anybody else could possibly be. and we cannot let him have a sleepy reelection.
Yeah.
We have to take it to him and take it to him on the, and by the way, Florida's a state that passed almost 2-1, giving felons the right to vote and raising the minimum wage to $15.
And then they sandbagged it, the Florida legislature did.
Well, I understand that, but yeah. Of course they do. But at any rate, I think they, you know, that there's probably less than a moderate chance that you have a chance to win that Senate seat, but there's a 100% chance you can make them pay. And sometimes mm-hmm. in politics, you got to do that.
Pete, in Raleigh, North Carolina, my son lived in Raleigh for almost 3 years, just left last weekend. Pete says, I see a huge disconnect between Republicans like Larry Hogan, Mitt Romney, and Lisa Murkowski, and extremists like Kevin McCarthy and Josh Hawley. Pete wants to know, is there any hope that rational Republicans will regain control of the party so both sides can start working on reasonable compromises? Pete, in a word, no. No. I think... they're trying to run what they call reasonable Republicans, like this guy McCormick in Pennsylvania, who by my lights isn't very reasonable, and he may get beaten by one of the even craziers. So I think it's going to take this party a long time. I think the only thing that is going to change it is some kind of really big electoral defeat, and that's what happened after Goldwater. And that's what happened after Watergate. And James, sadly, I don't see that in the horizon.
Yeah, the Republican Party is not looking for Larry Hogan, okay? Mm-hmm. They in fact, they're looking for just the opposite. Look at what they nominated for governor. I mean, there is no interest in that. I'm not saying they're not a handful of good Republicans, because that's... in people's lifetime search, they're not going to win anything. No one wants them. The only people that want them is people who want to, like, feel good about themselves. They're not out, you know. Yeah, you can say Chris Sununu is not a bad guy, or Larry Hogan, maybe but Mitt Romney, they're not interested in them at all.
Yeah.
They have no interest in them.
Unfortunately, you're right. James in Carrollton, Illinois. You know where Carrollton, Illinois is? Is that anywhere near Mary's hometown? I don't know.
Well, Mary's from South Side of Chicago, so it sounds like a Chicago suburb, but I don't know that.
Well, we can check. But anyway, James is a conservative Republican, but he says he loves our podcast, even while he disagrees with us most of the time.
Right.
Okay. He's heard your take on the budget situation, and I hear all the time from Democrats saying, what are you going to cut? To be sure, he says, in a perfect world, everyone would want everything considered a priority. The question to you, James, is the reciprocal. How are Democrats, he asks, going to fund Biden's budget? We are many trillions of dollars in debt, and no one seems to care.
A good point, but Biden has put up a budget, right? Mm-hmm. Where is your budget? Understand that the Constitution, and I appreciate that you like the show. I appreciate that we have a somewhat of a difference of opinion. I actually kind of think we're in a lot of debt myself, but be that as it may, give us your budget. The Constitution mandates that spending start again in the House. Where is it? Right? So you Biden's there. You say it doesn't pay for things. It explodes the debt even more. By the way, David Jolly, the former Republican congressman from Florida, and I saw him, and he's he's a former congressman. I don't know if he's probably still a Republican, but I don't know. But he's Trump, he's a never Trumper, is a scholar on the federal budget. I asked him about it, and he lit up. Down 25% of the entire accumulated debt of the United States is like $32 million, was acquired during the 4 years that Donald Trump was president. Now, figure the country started in, I think, what was it, probably 1789?
Through to the around then.
So you have 4 years of that puts 25% of the total debt we have. And, you know, the president submitted a budget. You know, everybody, you've covered budgets for 50 years. The first opening graph is always it's debt on arrival. Okay.
Right.
But
right.
It's there. Okay. It's there. They don't have one. They don't have one. So you can't even be dead if you never were born. They have not tried. And you're going to see me on television from here forward saying, excuse me, where's your budget? You want to pivot to kitchen table issues and, these prosecutions or distractions. Good. Produce your budget. Produce your budget. Yep. That's all I want to see.
Don't hold your breath, James. Don't hold your breath. Mary Ann in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, who, by the way, has been a fan of yours since the War Room and been a fan of mine since the old Washington Week in Review. Mary Ann, you must have been a toddler back then. But she said, perhaps you could hear me screaming in northern New Jersey at the notion that we apparently raised, we did, of a presidential pardon for the man who was behind a merry band of insurrectionists who invaded the Capitol. Do you really think a pardon would help heal the nation? Do you think Ford's pardon of Nixon helped our democracy? Let me take that, Marianne. What we said was it would be a hard call if you could get Trump to A, acknowledge guilt, B, agree to a fine, C, promise never to run for office again, and D, be able to persuade local district attorneys to go along with those terms. I think that's a very hard call. My inclination would be to say, hold my nose and take the deal. And yeah, I think in retrospect, I wish Ford would have gotten more of an admission of guilt from Nixon, but I do. I think it helped us move on. So I'm not going to please you, but I hope I at least explain my position in this. James?
Yeah, I appreciate where you're coming from. And my guess is this is an entirely hypothetical situation that's never going to happen. But we try to do is put provocative things out there to say, what would you do if this happened? And I could understand your reluctance to go along with something like this, and it probably won't happen, but provokes a good conversation.
Yeah, it does. James, finally, Mary in Ivins, Utah. We haven't heard from anyone in Utah
I've been out there a bunch of times, but that's one of the nicest people in Salt Lake City. I don't know where Ivan is, but Salt Lake City is a hell of an interesting place. You know, not to mention, that they have some of the best mountains you can anywhere in Utah. But I'm a very pro-Utah guy.
Listen, my assistant, when she's not working on her full-time job, is the very talented and attractive Adrienne Carter, who is from Utah. And I got to tell you, she is a gem. So, Mary, we're very big on Utah. You know, a few episodes ago, James, you mentioned the commission on presidential debates was no longer relevant and should be ended. Why? And would you replace it with something else? Don't you think there needs to be a platform, Mary asked, where all Americans can see two candidates on stage live debating each other? How else are we to judge the difference?
Well I'll give you a number of reasons. The first thing is, it's Sal kind of appointed, and you had Frank Farenkoff, who was there, and we're trying to get a debate, and of course he has one. Because he's a lobbyist for the gaming or whatever, the gambling. I call it gambling, they call it gaming. And then they were swapping stuff back and forth. I think you need to have debates. I just think the commission, it's totally dictated by the campaigns. And the truth of that is, we really don't have debates. We have the equivalent of joint press conferences. When this subject comes hotter as we approach election year, we should get like Sidney Blumenthal on here to talk about what the Lincoln Douglas debates were. They were like 2 hours affair, but I'm all for it. I just think that this has just become like everything else, a place for lobbyists to exercise influence, and we need to figure out a better way to do this.
Yeah, and James, to buttress your point, in virtually every gubernatorial and Senate contest and many House contests last fall, there were debates, and there were no commissions. They're just staged. I agree. I think it's outlived any usefulness it had, and it's time to move on.
Yeah, I think the destination is noble. I mean, I think we need a different vehicle to get there.
All right, keep those questions coming in. They are so good. And if we didn't get to yours this week, we'll get to it next week. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you'd check out the links to our sponsors, Lomi and Hold On Bags, in the show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them. When you do, you help make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room and Apple Podcast, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.